This is The Guardian.
I'm Bridie Jabbour, coming to you from Gadigal land. And this is Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia editors discuss the news of the week. What role should religion play in the political lives of our leaders?
I have always believed in miracles.
For former Prime Minister Scott Morrison, faith has always been front and centre. And with the release of his book, Morrison goes deep into how his beliefs guided him through his political career.
I leave this place appreciative and thankful and released from any bitterness that can so often haunt post-political lives. This is due to my faith in Jesus Christ.
So in a multi-faith and sometimes agnostic country like Australia, where does religion fit into public life? And can faith drive the decision-making of those who run the country? Today, Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Deputy Editor Patrick Keneally on the relationship between church and state. It's Friday, the 3rd of May.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Bridie.
Good morning, Patrick.
Morning, Bridie.
We are going to be talking about two things you're not supposed to discuss in polite society today, politics and religion. We've been thinking about this because of the release of Scott Morrison's book, Plans for Your Good, A Prime Minister's Testimony of God's Faithfulness. It's not exactly a memoir, though, is it, Lenore?
Well, it kind of is. I mean, Scott Morrison is a different type of Christian than previous leaders. We've had lots of leaders who have had Christian faith, usually. Scott Morrison's a Pentecostal, so that means this is a very different kind of political memoir in that there's heaps more Bible verses in it than any discussion of policy or any discussion of, you know, political machinations. It's kind of written entirely through the lens of his faith. You know, what it meant for politics is sort of the consequence, not the main point of the book. And I guess it's sort of a testimony that faith always came first for him, which we sort of knew when he was Prime Minister, but this makes it really, really absolutely clear. I mean, you know, like all of us, Prime Ministers can worship who they want, how they want. But I think the absolute clarity this gives us about the absolute centrality of a direct and kind of literal relationship with God that Scott Morrison had really does raise different kinds of questions about how faith influenced his leadership. I found it very interesting, and it's really not like any other political memoir you've ever read.
I think I found this, out of all the podcasts we've done, the most fascinating to research in many ways. Yeah. Because, yeah, it does raise these really interesting questions about people's faith. And I also got the feeling reading this memoir that there was so much that was unseen in his faith during his prime ministership that we are only just getting to know about now. And I think that's the difference with many of the other, you know, we've had Catholics, Methodists, Presbyterian prime ministers, we've had Anglicans. But with all of those faiths, the dogma, the beliefs are much more out in the open.
Or maybe much more familiar.
Or much
to
more familiar,
most
perhaps.
People,
yeah. Whereas this felt almost culturally very different to something that we'd understood and known about before.
And yet we always knew that he was a Pentecostal, right? Like, you know, his election night victory speech.
I have always believed in miracles. And tonight we've been delivered another one.
And he invited media to come to his church and witness his prayer. He wasn't, and I don't mean that in any way that he was trying to hide his faith.
But he didn't put it way out there like this either. Yeah, exactly. And remember when he revealed in that speech to a church that he was doing the laying of hands on people that he visited in disaster zones? I may be showing my ignorance here. I think that means the Holy Spirit goes through the religious person and helps the person who they're trying to comfort.
Yeah, and he saw it as a way that he was directly helping people.
Yeah, and the people involved didn't always or probably didn't know that he was doing it. But anywho, that's another whole conversation.
I've been in evacuation centres where people thought I was just giving someone a hug and I was praying and putting my hands on people in various places, laying hands on them and praying in various situations.
So what does Scott Morrison actually say about his faith in this book?
I guess the thing that's really clear, clearer than it was when he was Prime Minister, is the extent to which he believes that God was informing his decision-making. I mean, he says, Christians in politics must be humble when it comes to God's agency and their own political objectives. It is God who does the anointing, not us. He's also clear that the subjects that they're dealing with are matters for politics and need to be dealt with through the democratic process. So it's not so much the distinction between where does religion come into decision-making that is the issue. It is that he believes that every single decision he made every day is informed by or almost directed by God. I mean, he says, our duty is to align with God, not conscript him to our causes and ambitions. Let's not fall into the trap of framing God into our own political agenda. Politics is not religion and your faith is not your politics. It's more important than that. So it's not that faith informs his ethics or his inner world. It's that he sees God as giving him quite literally daily guidance. I mean, he transcribes conversations that he has with God and God's words are in italics. He sees God as directly informing or working through him. It's that very literal understanding of faith. And I think that's quite different from other prime ministers that we've had.
I found it very interesting where he talked about being guided by the Holy Spirit in the leadership spill.
Yeah.
And getting literal instructions about how he should conduct himself during the leadership spill. There's one section in it where he talks about feeling attacked by his enemies, and there's a whole section where it says, so, Scott, you think your enemies are getting the better of you.
That's God talking.
Yeah, God talking.
Yep.
You think you've been unfairly treated, you've been humiliated and mocked, people are lying and misrepresenting you. You may have heard about some of my experiences. Sorry, this is Jesus at this point. My friends deserted me when I needed them most. My people lied about me and believed the lies they told about me. Even in my hometown, they rejected me. I was betrayed by one of my closest friends. And I just find that quite unusual. A lot of it comes across as a bit of a self-help book, almost like Jordan Peterson type 10 Rules for Life. And in it, he talks about disappointment with losing the election and, you know, losing his job at Tourism Australia. And he says, we all deal with disappointment in life, but regardless of their cause, bitterness is not the answer. Then about two pages later, he says, after I lost the election, my opponents were not content to leave it there. In Australian politics, we call this a pile-on. Not satisfied with my defeat, they engaged in a campaign to humiliate, discredit, and cancel me. It was graceless, brutal, and it hurt. So it was a bit of a whiplash between I'm not bitter, but also sounding like you're quite bitter.
And there's also those bits where he has sort of prayer sessions with Mike Pence and Pompeo, you know, quite soon after meeting them. It's a very interesting world.
Mm. Also prayer sessions with Kevin Rudd.
Kevin Rudd said that they were in the same prayer group. And I mean, there's always been a parliamentary prayer group that pray together going back years. Mm.
Kevin Rudd, even before he became opposition leader in 2006, was talking about an alternative vision for Australia's future shaped by Christian values. That was quite controversial at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But all of those previous leaders who were religious didn't have this sort of very direct and literal understanding of it. So for Kevin Rudd, and he wrote a whole essay about faith in politics for the Monthly, and for him it was in part a reaction to how he saw John Howard sort of co-opting religion as a conservative construct, and he saw religion as not being like that at all, that he was a man of faith. His great hero, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, was a man of faith. And to him, faith was sort of meaning that you needed to always take the side of vulnerable, marginalised people. And he kind of saw his faith as almost the antithesis of individualism and conservatism, if you like. So he had a different interpretation of faith, but it was also a more individual, inner, spiritual thing for him, not a literal relationship with God above that was telling him how to make political decisions, which is more the framing that Morrison has.
Yeah, I think Rudd typified, some of the academics talk about three phases of Christianity in politics in Australia, where you had the sectarian divide between Catholics and Protestants, which kind of divided politics for a long time of the 20th century. Then you started, you know, under Howard, this kind of Catholic migration into the Liberal Party and a strong identification with Christianity and the conservative side of politics. But then Rudd typified this perhaps move back to a more individual spiritual self-identification with religion.
Which is sort of also the way Malcolm Turnbull looked at
Malcolm
it, right?
Turnbull
he had a similar kind of faith.
And Tony Abbott said at one point, "Render unto God the things that are God's and unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's," when he was talking about the separation of faith and politics. But his Catholicism ended up playing a role in the RU486 debate, didn't it?
I mean, it was a bigger role than that. I mean, there was a real sort of questioning of faith in politics around Tony Abbott when he became health minister in the Howard government. Everyone knew he was a conservative Catholic. You know, he'd trained as a Catholic priest. His colleagues used to call him the mad monk. And as health minister, he had quite direct control over a bunch of different things to do with women's reproductive rights. And he gave a speech denouncing the number of abortions in Australia. And then he wanted to keep ministerial control of the importation powers for RU486, the abortion drug, and that actually ended up going to a conscience vote in the parliament. And so that was a time when this issue of how should politicians' faith inform their judgment and their decision-making really came to the fore. And I can remember talking to Tony Abbott about it at the time. And he had this sort of construction, which was, he said it was okay for him to take a position that was in line with the church's teachings, so long as a rational person who wasn't religious at all could reasonably form the same view. So that was his construction. That's how he justified what he was doing and what he was saying. I think a lot of, you know, particularly women, but a lot of people would have disagreed with that and felt quite uncomfortable about what they saw as the extent to which his Catholic faith was informing his decision-making. But that was the way that he justified it in his mind.
Look, that debate over RU486 is going back quite a while. I was at university at the time and I vaguely remember it. But I do remember another similar debate over stem cell research, which was actually quite interesting. And really, it was not just Tony Abbott. There were people on both sides of the parliament who had ethical concerns about it. Much of that was sort of animated by religious belief. But, you know, some of these issues, we talk about conscience votes, but they're not always religious conscience votes.
No. But to me, the central question is, to what extent is it appropriate for your religious views to inform your political decision-making or, in some cases, override other advice, other facts, other issues that might be on the table when you're making a decision? I mean, it's where you draw that line the question.
I thought Rudd, in his monthly essay, actually had a good framework for this. And he said that, you know, his understanding of God and the gospel was, it was a social construct and that it kind of created the moral framework in which he could make these decisions. But he said, you know, should that mean that every single decision about what you do about defence spending or what you do about, you know, health spending or Medicare, should these be, you know, does the Bible tell us what to do? Of course it doesn't. Mm. No, you can't make those decisions on the
basis
of faith.
And it has to be tempered by rationality.
But he says that the framing of the debate, when you have that debate, it can be informed by, I guess, Christian ethics and a religious sensibility. When you're having that debate, but the decision should be based on rationality.
And even politicians who aren't religious have their own personal beliefs and personal experiences that inform their decisions as well. It's not just religious politicians.
No.
Exactly. Everybody brings their own beliefs or their own views to any decision that you make in politics.
So as journalists, what responsibility do we have to report on the faith of politicians?
I guess only insofar as we're doing in this conversation, which is to think about how it relates or affects their decision-making or their exercise of their office. I mean, we live in a country with freedom of religion and their, you know, politicians are free to practice whatever religion they want. And mostly religion is a very private and personal thing. But I think it is appropriate and also necessary to consider the religion of prime ministers, say, in relation to how we think that affects their decision-making.
I think it's useful sometimes to draw a bigger picture of, like, the type of person they are, yeah, as true. Well, because I think it really informs some of their values. I think for, like, Paul Keating, who was a Catholic, but I don't think of practicing one for much of his life, he often talked about, like, how it defined him. There's a quote from him, "Catholicism gives this view that we're born equally and die equally and that none of us is intrinsically worth more than another." And I think for him it was a really big sort of part of his identity and the way he governed.
Or Anthony Albanese, the same. You know, he always says he's got three great faiths, rugby league, club, South Sydney Rabbitohs, the Labor Party and the Catholic Church. So he nominates it as something integral to his being, to who he is. It's relevant to know him.
Yeah.
So does his type of faith raise a completely different set of questions about religion in politics than we've previously encountered with leaders?
Yeah, I think it really does. I mean, how does a leader question himself or have self-doubt or test his decisions if he really believes that God is making decisions through him? And does that lead to an appropriate level of certainty or uncertainty? Does it lead to an appropriate or inappropriate level of self-reflection or second thoughts? If you really think that you have prayed and God has given you the answer that you're then implementing it, I mean, you wouldn't question it then, would you? Because that's questioning God and that's against the way that your religion works. So is that what leads a bloke to swear himself into five extra ministries and not think it's wrong? I mean, is that what gave him that sort of absolute self-belief and certainty and kind of imperviousness to outside questioning and criticism? I think flexibility and self-reflection and doubt are good things in leaders. And I guess my concern or my thought reading his book, his faith is absolutely genuine. And I think he approached the job with absolute good intentions. But that degree of certainty that God is informing what you do would do something to your leadership, I think.
He talked about himself being the bulldozer, about, you know, punching his way through. And you wonder to what extent that sense of righteousness and steadfastness in his views contributed to, you know, his reputation.
Yeah. I think Kevin Rudd wrote a piece for us in 2021, right after that speech came out where Morrison revealed that he sometimes laid hands on people.
To believe that you have some divine mandate as a prime minister to lay your hands on somebody without their concurrence or knowledge and pray for them when you're meeting and greeting or comforting them as prime minister, that's way in excess of your mandate as the secular prime minister of this country.
And Rudd's view was that there were a couple of problems with Pentecostalism in particular in terms of being a national leader. He said one problem was that it effectively consigns responsibility for things on earth to God, which kind of sometimes takes away from the responsibility that you need to take as a leader, as a human living on earth for those things.
The idea that anyone leading a political party could believe that it is, you know, God on our side is just the stuff of real danger, in my view.
And then he sort of said that the overall problem with Morrison's theology or his type of faith was that it undermines the role of reason and evidence and fact.
We are a proudly secular country where people who are agnostics, atheists, Christians, Calathumpians can compete for office in our secular national parliament. That's as it should be.
And that, you know, the mainstream church, going right back, had always considered that faith should be tempered by reason, and that the fundamentalist traditions was sort of less tempered by reason and more sort of fundamentalist.
I think Mr. Morrison and myself have radically different views on the role of Christianity in Australian politics.
And he says that that worldview sits uncomfortably with the extraordinary powers of the secular office of prime minister. And I guess that, for me, hit the mark about the kinds of questions that came up when I read this book.
So are Australian politics junkies the audience for this book?
Look, I don't think so. It seems like it's written really for an American audience in many ways.
An American Christian audience.
Evangelical audience, yeah. So he explains everything from AFL football or rugby league football to what the Shire is. He says it's a...
Hobbits
don't actually live there. And there's other bits throughout the book where he explains, you know, I mentioned the pylon. So he explains Australian political terms in there for readers, which you wouldn't see in a normal political memoir because there would be a bit of assumed knowledge there.
And the fact that it is far more about religion than it is about politics. Like religion is the foreground of things and the political ramifications are the afterthought suggests that, yeah, it's absolutely for an American Christian audience than an Australian political audience.
And you do wonder whether this is part of some career pivot or shift that he might be planning.
Next.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Sobering data and an airline collapse. And now it's time for what we can't get out of our heads. What's that been for you this week, Lenore?
For me, it was a thing called One Big Chart, which our data analyst Josh Nicholas does. It's basically a graph, but illustrated, if you like. And this week he did it about domestic violence, and it looks at the number of people hospitalised for every 10,000 people. So in 2022, for every 10,000 people, 76 Indigenous women were hospitalised by family violence, 24 Indigenous men, 23 non-Indigenous women, and 0.89 non-Indigenous men. So to make the sort of comparison between Indigenous and non-Indigenous women, 76 Indigenous women, 2.3 non-Indigenous women. And just seeing it depicted the way he did was like a gut punch in terms of the debate that's going on this week, and I really can't get it out of my head.
It was incredibly striking. And Patrick, what can't you get out of your head?
I thought the collapse of another airline in Australia, Bonza, which was a competitor to the incumbents, Jetstar, Qantas and Virgin, was quite bad news for Australian travellers. And it is another dot point in the series of failures of competition in the airline sector. Over the last 20 or 30 years, we've had everything from Impulse to Compass to Tiger Air, which have all basically encountered the same problem in that there are a couple of incumbent operators in the Australian aviation industry that are really hard to compete with. And it means that we're all paying much higher fares. John Quiggin wrote a good piece about it this week, if you're interested in it. And I just don't see any way that this will change anytime soon.
Thank you so much for joining me this week, Lenore and Patrick.
Thanks, Brady.
Pleasure.
That's it for today. This episode was produced by Camilla Hannon and James Milsom. The executive producer was Miles Martignoni. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Full Story and you can leave us a rating or review. I'm Brady Jabor, and Jane Lee will be back with Full Story on Monday.